Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We're very pleased to have our guest today, Justice Deborah Lehrman from the Texas Supreme Court. Welcome, Justice Lehrman, to our podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. Thank you.
Well, we're excited. We're slowly making our way through the members of the Texas Supreme Court. So we have had the privilege of having several of your colleagues on the show with a few more yet to get. But it's really nice to see you and nice to have you with us. One thing we like to do, Justice Lehrman, is ask our guests to kind of introduce themselves to our listeners. We are the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, but we have a lot of trial lawyers who listen and people from outside Texas as well. So let's let the audience get to know you a little bit, if you'll tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe your background, your path to the law, and so forth.
Sure. Well, I am Deborah Lehrman. I am now the senior justice on the court and the longest serving woman to ever serve on the Supreme Court of Texas in the history of the state. So I'm very thrilled about that. If you would have asked me years ago if I would ever be in this position, I would have just started laughing and maybe fallen off a chair or something, because that's just not what I envisioned for my future. But here I am, and so blessed and so absolutely thrilled to be able to serve the jurisprudence of the state of Texas, the people of the state of Texas, the third branch of government in the way that I'm so fortunate to be able to. It's just wonderful. I went to the University of Texas as an undergraduate student, and I was getting my degree in psychology and thought I wanted to go on and get a PhD in psychology. That was really my plan, to become a professional counselor. So I did an internship my junior and senior year in undergrad there at UT at the Austin State Hospital. And it was very difficult on me. The people who are in that position, unfortunately, of having to reside in that facility are very, very challenged. They have such incredibly sad lives, such incredibly stressful backgrounds that often brought them to that place. And so here I was, a young undergrad student who loved to be with people and to have fun and to study hard, but also to have fun. And on Friday evening after working at the state hospital, I would come home and just want to go to bed at 8 o'clock. And that was not like me. So I started looking at these people's files, and I was in the women's unit, and I was struck by how many of these young women had been sexually abused as children. It was very, very, very dominant theme. And so that really made me start thinking, as I realized that this therapist role was not going to be for me. And so that's when I really got serious about wanting to go to law school, because I thought if I could reach people sooner in their lives before things got so out of whack, that it could really make a difference. And so that's really what drew me in the first instance to go to law school. I mean, I kind of thought about it in the past. My father was a doctor. My father had encouraged me not to be a doctor, which is interesting, not because I was a woman or anything like that, but because doctors work so hard. And he knew that I wanted to have a family and I wanted to have children and et cetera. So as I was a young lawyer, fast forward, working in a large law firm at the time, being at work till back then, you couldn't really do much virtually. You did everything in the library. And so it was very common for us to be in the office until 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I just remember thinking, boy, Dad was kind of not really hitting it right on the mark when he thought this is going to be a lot, you know, less time consuming.
Did he know any lawyers?
He didn't know any lawyers. We didn't have any lawyers in our family. It was all a doctor family. My father was a doctor. My grandfather was a doctor. So the law was kind of a new area for us, but that's kind of what got me into it to begin with.
Well, in your practice experience, as I recall, and I mean, it was geared toward family law. And I would imagine that influenced what you experienced with the Austin State Hospital and investigating the backgrounds of the patients and so forth. It seems like that's sort of a natural fit. And that, I suppose, I'll just ask the question, did that greatly influence your decision to practice primarily in the area of family law?
Yes. I mean, I kind of went into it with that in mind. I first started out at the DA's office, well, as a prosecutor in Fort Worth, and was handling those types of cases having to do with child protection work, et cetera. And it's kind of interesting. I ended up really liking the work. I really liked the courtroom, was very comfortable in the courtroom, which I didn't particularly expect. Like I say, I didn't come from a family of lawyers. I went to law school without any really assistance in terms of understanding what law school was going to be like or anything like that. So I never really thought at all that I would be particularly good in the courtroom or like it, but I ended up really liking it a lot and being very comfortable. And so I did that for a few years. And then I went with a large law firm in Fort Worth, Law Snickard and Gamble. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the three largest law firms in town were Law Snickard and Gamble, Shannon Gracie, and Canny Hanger. And my husband was at Shannon Gracie and I was at Law Snickard. And so when I was there, I also, that was because the firm had decided back then there was really a push to accommodate their clients with full services and including family law. So that's what I was really hired to do to help head up that section. I also, however, did other things, of course, as you do when you're an associate at a large law firm. But that was where my focus was. And then when I became a judge at a very young age, by the way, I was a family law judge, trial judge for many years. But I met my husband in law school, also kind of going back. And so I actually grew up near Houston in a town, small town called Baytown. And my husband grew up in Fort Worth. We both went to the University of Texas, undergrad and law school, and that's where we met. And then as young lawyers, we were interviewing, as young lawyers do. But at this point in time, we had gotten pretty serious. And so we were both interviewing in the Houston area and in the DFW area. And it just so happens that we both got jobs in the DFW area first. And so that's why we ended up in DFW and were there for many, many years until the governor appointed me to the Supreme Court. Then we went back and forth for quite a while. And then more recently, we have settled in Austin. Although I must say, Austin is our second home. I love Austin, but Fort Worth will always be home because we were there for so long.
I can understand that.
Well, and I can too, because Fort Worth is my hometown. So we have a lot of affinity for Fort Worth here on the show today.
I always tell people that Fort Worth is a small town with a whole lot of people.
Absolutely.
When you look at Tarrant County, there's a lot of people there, but we all know each other and we all support each other. And it's just a wonderful place to be. And the legal community is very tight knit. The legal community in Austin reminds me quite a bit of Fort Worth. It's very tight knit also, even though there's more lawyers, it's a very tight knit legal community. And so I've really enjoyed that about coming back to Austin after so many years being gone, practicing law and raising a family in Fort Worth.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with Quick Check on Westlaw Edge.
You mentioned going on the trial bench. That's one of the things we wanted to talk about. How did you get from the private practice to the trial bench?
Like I say, I had enjoyed the courtroom. And so as I'm in the courtroom, I started just realizing that being a part of the judiciary would probably be a good fit for me and that I would really enjoy it. And so when I was first appointed, I was appointed as an associate judge, which was, and those are judges who really do comparable work as the district judges, but they're appointed by the board of district judges, at least that's how it was in Fort Worth. And I think that's how it is in most places. And then any decision that's made by the associate judge could be appealed. I mean, today it's called a trial de novo, but it's the same concept to the district court. And so I did that for a number of years. Then there became a vacancy actually on the trial court that I was an associate judge in. And so Governor Bush at the time appointed me to that bench as a district judge then. And then I did that for many, many years. I was a trial judge for 23 years.
Wow.
So a long time. And then I had always been interested in appellate work. And I always thought that I probably would become an appellate judge. I was doing a lot of writing. I wrote many law review articles. The Texas Bar Foundation recognized one of my works as something that they determined was the best law review article of the year. I wrote for LexisNexis. I would update the annotate the family code for them. I wrote another legal treatise on representation of children. So I was always writing and always publishing. And so that's where my love really has been, very much so, for many, many years. And people knew it because I was published. And I was also published nationally. I've been very involved in the American Bar Association, in the Uniform Law Commission, in the ALI, all these different national organizations. And I was doing a lot of writing and in those areas as well. So it was always kind of assumed in Fort Worth that I would go to the appellate bench. But what happened was, I mean, the intermediate appellate bench. But what happened was all of the other justices on the Fort Worth Court of Appeals were my age. And we all kind of have young children. And I wasn't going to run against one of my colleagues. That's not something I ever had any desire to do, nor would I ever do that. And so there never was an opening to run for the Intermediate Courts of Appeals. And so when Justice Harriet O'Neill announced that she was going to step down, it was just perfect timing. Greg and I have two boys. They were getting ready to go off to college, so we wouldn't have to be taking them out of their schools in Fort Worth and take them to Austin. And so it was just a perfect time. There was a real need on the court, and the court knew it at that time, for family law expertise. And so it was just a real good fit. And so that's when I decided to put my name in the hat for that position, and fortunately was successful.
How was the process of going from running kind of locally in Tarrant County to running a statewide election?
Oh, my goodness. Quite crazy. Texas is really big. And the thing about it is, you know, you're always going back and forth. You're going, you have a breakfast meeting in Austin and a lunch meeting in Houston and a dinner meeting back in Austin. And then the next morning, you've got to be in Dallas. And so you're crisscrossing constantly. And the question someone would ask, well, why in the world would you do that? Set it up so that you'll go to this part of the state and then you'll stay there and then you'll go to this. Well, it doesn't work that way. You go where the people are. And especially when you're first starting, nobody knows who any of us are still. And they certainly didn't back then. And so you go where the people are having big events. And it was never, ever in the same place, that's for sure. So lots of travel. One time I tell a story about, so we were in my hometown of Baytown. We had an event. it was one of those events that lasted pretty late into the evening. It probably didn't end till about 9 o'clock. And then Greg, who has been wonderful, wonderful, just companion, supporter, soulmate, he and I have done this together for sure. And so when he and I drove back to Fort Worth for a breakfast meeting, weren't able to leave Baytown till about 9:30 in the evening. And so as we were coming into Fort Worth, luckily very close to our home, Greg fell asleep we ended up in a ditch. Thank goodness that's all it was. And it was no big deal, but it could have been a big deal.
Sure.
And I often think, why in the world did we do that to get back to Fort Worth? Where, remember, it's a small town with a lot of people and everybody already knew us. But somehow we were compelled. We had to go to every single thing. So it's big. It's a lot. It's a challenge. But we got to meet lots of wonderful people. I don't particularly think that the way we select judges in the state is the correct way to do it. I think there's better ways to select judges. But I love the work I do. And this is the way we do it in Texas. So we play by the rules. And that means doing the things that I've just talked about.
Sure.
You have the good fortune of having been elected and reelected to your bench, and most recently back in November, reelected again. So I suppose can take a little bit of a pause and then before the election cycle ramps up again for the next go round, but our Supreme Court justices are elected to 6-year terms. And so you have that level of job security. And you mentioned earlier that you and Greg had sort of made Austin, you know, it's second home, but you're here the majority of the time, it seems like. And so having that an election behind you before you make that decision seems like a smart choice too.
Right. Yeah. It's nice to have that behind, at least for another 6 years, because there is a lot going on when you're trying to get from here to there. And also, of course, the work of the court is very, very intense. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with the most significant issues touching real people having to do with the jurisprudence of the state of Texas. And so very, very aware of the importance of the work. And so the campaign always takes a backseat to the real work of the court. But that means oftentimes we'll be traveling, you know, and I'll be in the backseat. We would joke in an SUV, I'd be in the trunk because I'm small and I'll fit. Wasn't really the trunk, but it kind of seemed like it. And there I am with all my papers and my laptop or my iPhone or whatever I'm working on at the time. The good news is nowadays, as we alluded to earlier, you can do this stuff away from the office. And it actually, in a lot of ways, it's better than being in the office to do it, because you do have quiet solitude so that you can really seriously study and contemplate these very heavy, important issues to make, because it's so important that we get it right, that we not just do it to get it out, but that we get the law right. That's so important.
Mm-hmm. One thing you mentioned was you brought just a wealth of family law experience that the court didn't really have. And it seems like that's kind of coincided with the court taking more family law and parental termination type cases. Is that, I know you don't want to take credit for that, but it seems like there definitely has been more of a focus in the last decade or so on family law at the court than there had been previously.
I think that what really happened was back whenever, you know, you remember in San Angelo when they had the big event where so many children had to be taken from that compound or were taken because of allegations of serious sexual abuse. And it was pretty overwhelming situation for the court, because obviously there were so many children who had allegedly been abused at very young ages. So there's a whole need of a lot of family law, not just expertise, but also manpower, because all of these children were entitled to court-appointed lawyers. And in any of these CPS cases, the parents are entitled to lawyers. Oftentimes, there's multiple fathers involved. The children are entitled to legal representation. And then you have costs involved. There's a lot going on there. And when you multiply by that by the many, 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 many children that were involved, it was very overwhelming. to the system and to the court. So that was kind of the start of it. And we had some appellate rules that have changed in terms of appellate rights having to do with CPS and terminations. So all of that has contributed to the increase in the number of cases that we have taken, not necessarily in family law generally, although I'm always looking for those particular issues because there are issues that really need to be settled that you may not know about that much if you weren't really in the trenches. And I do keep up with it a lot. And I'm always looking for those. But I wouldn't say those are any different than other areas of the law, oil and gas or sovereign immunity, you know, all the other things that we do.
Sure.
But in the CPS realm, it is different. And we do take a lot of those cases. And in fact, we have a mandamus lawyer. We call that our emergency docket because now it's also not just mandamus. It's all kinds of things, that, especially since the pandemic that have come up. And this CPS docket is close to, or maybe even more, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but close to half of that entire docket.
Oh, wow.
Now, I don't mean our entire docket, but that entire emergency docket. So that's a lot.
That is a lot.
There's a lot of those cases that come in front of us. And we are taking quite a few of those. But it's important to clarify.
Oh, sure. You mentioned the San Angelo situation and how it impacted the court. And that was, for those who don't know about that, was the Yearning for Zion Ranch going back, gosh, more than 10 years now, longer than that. But one thing that's worth probably mentioning there is that was an impressive pro bono effort on the bar's part in getting those kids represented. That was one of those moments where you felt good about being a lawyer, even though this terrible situation was going on out in West Texas. The Supreme Court, as it tends to do, took leadership in a difficult situation. And then the bar took on a really significant role in representing the folks that needed help back then. So I hadn't thought about that in quite some time, but you mentioned it and it made me think, oh, that was one of those sort of shining moments that you're really proud of being a lawyer in Texas.
Yeah, it was wonderful how the bar just stepped up. And we had no shortage of lawyers who were volunteering to assist in this really what was a crisis. And as always, we ask and the lawyers step up as they always do, and they did again. And it was, yes, it was a great thing.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
Well, one of the things when we have your colleagues on the show, we always like to ask about their liaison assignments because you've got obviously a very good and deep comfort level with family law. And I know family lawyers are their own tight-knit bunch. They have their annual CLE program down in San Antonio that makes all the rest of us a little bit jealous because they're getting together and having a good time. And we appellate lawyers, you know, we have pretty good CLE programs too, but that one's sort of famous in its own way. But other than your involvement, continued involvement in family law matters and the family law bar, what kind of liaison assignments are you serving at the court that are interesting or that you would like to talk about?
Well, they're all interesting, of course. But of course, the position that I really enjoy so much is it being the liaison to the State Bar of Texas. And it's so important. And it's something that I really enjoy. I love lawyers. I am married to a lawyer. We have two sons that are lawyers. Most of my friends are lawyers. Professionally, I've been around lawyers all my life. And so coming from a family, remember, of no lawyers, I went to the other extreme and just really so much appreciate the third branch of government and what we do as lawyers and its importance in our society. I think it can never be overstated. And it's something that I firmly believe. And so it's a joy to be able to serve in that role. It's also a natural fit because I have been involved in bar politics since I was a very young lawyer, starting with going up the ranks in Tarrant County Young Lawyers, becoming the president of Tarrant County Young Lawyers. Then I gotten, like I said earlier, very involved in the American Bar Association, worked through the ranks there, eventually became the chair of the family law section of the American Bar Association, and very involved in the Uniform Law Commission, which is a commission that's comprised of lawyers and judges and law professors from around the country who work very diligently on the uniform laws that we all use as models or as uniform acts for our various legislatures to adopt. And that's been a very rewarding experience also. And then also as a member of the American Law Institute, and currently I'm working on the restatement of children in the law. And so that's all very important, fascinating work that's very bar related. So I think the fit between me as the liaison and the State Bar of Texas really is a good one, I think, and one that I hope to continue to do for many, many years. But prior to that, I was the liaison BODA, which is the Board of Disciplinary Appeals. And I enjoyed that also because, of course, that's very important in terms of the whole disciplinary system with regard to attorneys and the service that we provide to the public. But whenever an opening came up on the State Bar of Texas, when Justice Phil Johnson stepped down, then I expressed to the chief that I would be interested in that liaison position. But there's no way that I could do Board of Disciplinary Appeals and the State Bar of Texas. And it was actually when I became, I'm also the chair of the Children's Commission, the Permanent Commission on Children, Youth, and Families. And that's a big, big liaison role also. So I was had to give up, so to speak, the liaisonship to BODA, which you hate to give up anything like that, but there's only so many hours in the day. But I really love that. And that's a part of the work that I think people don't really realize. Lawyers know intellectually, but don't really realize how much time those liaison roles take. And it's important. It's stuff that we really, really need to devote a lot of time to. And we do. We all do.
Will you talk just a little bit about the Children's Commission and the work that it does? Because I bet a lot of people don't know what they do.
Right. Well, the commission was actually created whenever Harriet O'Neill was stepping down or during that period of time from her transition. She was there a few years. She was really the mastermind behind it. And it really did grow from this experience that came out of San Angelo and an attempt to try to fill whatever void may have existed with regard to those kinds of cases. So the commission is comprised of primarily lawyers who are assisting judges. It's really to assist the judicial branch of government to make sure that judges have the training, not the facilities so much, but the tools that they need so that they can make sure that these children and families that are affected so tragically when there have been allegations of abuse or neglect by them against their children, to make sure that the professionals from the judicial side are equipped to deal with that adequately. And so the commission does a lot of work and looks at resources throughout the state and throughout the country. We are just now doing a project on developing standards for representation of parties, including parents and children who represent these individuals in these types of cases, because standards are important, of course, so that we can make sure that we're not just doing the bare minimum, but we are, in fact, really implementing best practices so that we can be the best we can for this very challenged segment of our society. And I think it's been very successful.
And to that point, too, Judge, you mentioned Uniform Law Commission. Family law is one of those areas, especially when you're talking about child custody issues, you really do need that sort of uniformity in the law between the states, because that's a hugely litigated issue when you've got custody and support issues. And our current society, you know, people move, they move around a lot, they move between states. And it does make a lot of sense that there would need to be a big effort made. And so I'm not a family lawyer. I don't practice family law really at all. But it does seem, from what I've observed, that work does seem to be super important just because of the need to preserve stability in the party's expectations across state lines. So,
and that's where the UCCJEA came from, which of course is the act that has to do with jurisdiction, because there are a lot of jurisdictional issues in terms of, can a parent just leave a state and go to another state in order to avoid whatever they want to be avoiding from that particular state? And so that's the reason, or one of the reasons, that it's so important. We also have a uniform act that has to do with military. Same kind of idea. When you have a military spouse that, say, has been deployed to another state, then can that spouse somehow take advantage of certain laws that may be more friendly to them in that other state? And so we have an act that many states have adopted that clarifies when that can and when that cannot happen. So to avoid that kind of game playing that can go on. But the commission does all kinds of things. I mean, like I say, one of the jewels of the Uniform Law Commission is the UCC, which of course is always being updated. And we are always in the process of having a drafting committee deal with that. The process that the ULC employs, when I first got involved many years ago, I was actually an ABA advisor. I'd been appointed by the American Bar Association on a drafting committee. And through that process, I saw how the whole ULC process works. And unlike many state legislatures where you have a lot of personal interests going on, whereas there's just a lot of negotiation, not really particularly to get to the right answer, but just, you know, you give me this and I'll give you that. And then you end up with who knows what. This process is very different in the sense that you've got experts, law professors, et cetera, from different areas of the law, depending on whatever that particular issue is, who are going to come in and give their expert opinions. And then we bring in stakeholders from different areas to make sure that we are dealing with competing views about what the public policy should be. And it's vetted, and it goes through a process of at least 2 years of intense study and discussion of what should go into these uniform laws. And then it goes to the committee of the whole, as we call it, which is all the commissioners throughout the states. And there's about 300 and something. And every summer we meet for quite a bit of about 7 days. And we read through every act that's currently on the table line by line. So you can imagine it's a very, very intense process that takes a lot of time. But it's a very, very good process to come up with uniform acts that have really been vetted by objective experts who have debated the issue a lot and then come up with what that committee or that commission has determined is the best policy decision for that area of the law. And so that's really why I got involved, because I just thought the process was so well done and not just a bunch of arguing or special interest that we know goes on in the various legislatures when they're coming up with legislation. So it's been a very, very, and this coming year, I will come in as a 20-year member. So I've been doing this for a long time. And it's very, very rewarding. We have a Uniform Act on the faithful. I forgot exactly what we call it, but it's the faithful something of Electoral College members. So we do all kinds of things. Interesting. You know, that really do. We have a Uniform Act on the anti-SLAPP statute, which, of course, we see a lot of that before us now.
Definitely.
So do other states. It's something that's really pressing issues that had, for a very good reason, that we have these statutes, but it had become so broad that almost anything was being subjected to dismissal at the very front end of the lawsuit simply by bringing a motion to dismiss under, for us, it's the TCPA or but whatever it is in the various states. And there's acts on all kinds of issues like that.
I do want to talk about some recent developments at the Supreme Court as of the last less than 2 weeks, and some things that are happening in our state. But before I do that, I did want to ask you just generally, what was something that you learned after joining the Supreme Court that you maybe didn't expect or that was surprising to you?
Or maybe different?
Or different.
Well, when you're a trial judge, you're the boss. Mm-hmm. I mean, you make a ruling, you make a decision, you affirm, you overrule, whatever you do, and that's it. There's no negotiation. Of course, you negotiate in your own mind to make sure that you get it right in every case, because it's just as important to get it right at that level as it is at the appellate level. But you're the one making that final decision. On the Supreme Court, you are trying to convince a majority of the court, that is, depending on what level of the process we're at, but certainly to grant review, I try to convince three of my colleagues that this is something we need to take, if I believe it is, and then four colleagues to have a majority on any opinion. And that really entails a lot of sort of negotiation skills, kind of going back to being a lawyer, that you really don't have to deal with, or I don't know if that's the correct phrase, but you don't deal with it when you're a trial judge. And I really hadn't thought about it that much, because as reading all of these cases and being involved at the level I was, you think of it more just in terms of researching, writing, studying, get it right. And there is a lot of that that goes on. But you also, like, for example, right after we have oral argument and say, we all know by random assignment which case we've gotten by the time we get into that phase of the lawsuit, we know the case by that time very, very well. We've read all the petitions. We've done a lot of research. We've done our own internal research. We've gotten free full briefing by all parties. We've gotten quite a bit of amicus lots of times. We've read all of that kind of stuff. And so people, one thing they ask me a lot of times, so why even have oral argument? Well, you would be surprised. Oral argument does help a lot in terms of kind of maybe redirecting the focus or making you think about something in a different light. It's probably not something we haven't thought about because we've read all this stuff so thoroughly by the time we get to that phase, but we may not be thinking of it in the way that the lawyer is articulating it that really was not obvious from the briefing. So that can really change things quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So you go into the first conference after oral argument, after we have already done what we call a post-sub memo, expressing our views to the other eight justices. And then we talk about it. And during that discussion, as we're talking about it, you get a feel at that point of time if you're going to have to move, how much you're going to have to move in order to keep the majority, whether you are going to be able to keep the majority, all those kind of things that I really hadn't thought about before I got on the court. And it's a major part of what you do. Mm-hmm. And actually, for me, over the years, I've learned more and more, I would prefer to keep the majority if I can, because that is going to mean that the law is going to be written more in accordance, which I believe is the correct application of the law. However, that means I'm going to maybe have to shift quite a bit. So it wouldn't be exactly what I believe would be the correct application. But if I don't do that, the alternative is that you give the majority up, you become the dissent. And what is that? Mm-hmm. That's Deborah Lehrman's opinion. Big deal. You know? And so those are the kind of things you kind of learn while you're actually doing it, and how much that really becomes a big part of the entire process. Mm-hmm. In a way, as much as the studying and writing and reading part of it, although that's involved too, because then to get to that point where you can shift a little bit, you're not going to shift to the point where the law is not applied correctly. So, of course, that takes a lot of doing in the process to get to that point also. But I really didn't expect that.
Yeah. And it's hard from the outside because nobody really sees that. You know, we send our briefs, maybe we go to oral argument and then you get an opinion, but we don't see everything that goes from the point you get our briefs. Just out of curiosity, when you pick up a petition or a brief, where do you start when you read? Like, what's kind of the first thing you go to?
The statement of the case, because you really get from that, it's just kind of a very condensed version of what's going on. And you can tell, what issue is this? Is this an issue that has to do with the Tort Claims Act? Is this an issue that has to do with First Amendment issues, anti-SLAPP, what is it?
Sure.
And then you get through the whole, in a very brief way, what's going on and what the lower courts have done. Mm-hmm. And I have a template that I use for every case where I'm just kind of outlining those kinds of things, because you're just trying to get, and remember, we read so much.
Sure.
There's a lot of reading going on. So we have to be able to kind of assimilate what's going on in this particular case quickly, because we have so many other things to read. And we do all read every single petition that comes in. We made that assurance to the appellate bar years ago, and we really have lived up to that. So we read a lot. The good news is we all like to read, or not. This is not a job for you. But you learn also how to kind of get to it quickly, you know. And then immediately I can just go through and know what I have to fill in so that I have a good concept of what this issue is, and then go to the Court of Appeals opinion and read it to figure out what their legal analysis of what was going on. And that's kind of the most efficient way that I've figured out how to do it.
Your discussion right before reminded me that you may be the author of an opinion that winds up being a majority, but it's worth remembering or being reminded that it's the opinion of the court.
Right.
And it's you and at least four other justices generally. And yes, I'm sure that the first draft of an opinion may not look a whole lot like what the final draft that's actually published looks like, because you've got eight other elected justices on that court that have very strong opinions about the law. But I can imagine that that process of collaboration actually can strengthen opinions sometimes.
Oh, it does. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I always talk about how we challenge each other, but we challenge each other in a very respectful way. And both of those parts of it are very, very important. And when I've spoken at CLA, sometimes, especially younger lawyers will ask me, what do you mean? We disagree, but we do it agreeably. Well, if I read an opinion that one of my colleagues has put on the table and I disagree with a certain aspect of it, I may agree with the outcome, but I don't agree with a certain part of the analysis, I have one of two ways to deal with that. I could say, well, this is just the silliest thing I've ever read in my life. Where in the world did you come up with this? Or I can point out that I certainly respect the work that they've done, and I'm just trying to understand, why is it that they have come up with this answer and I've come up with another answer? Mm-hmm. And so let's try to work through that. And so we do work through that a lot of times, and we end up with a much, much better product. One of the scariest things I think that ever happens for any of us is when we put a writing on the table, it goes around and everybody agrees with it immediately. You know, everyone's like, wait a minute. We might want a few more eyes to be looking at this a little bit on the same level that we just looked at it. So you really kind of don't want that. Mm-hmm. And really, when that's happened many times, we will pull it ourselves. Let's give it one more go through and just make sure. Because there's things, of course, when we're drafting that we'll be thinking, well, what about this? You know, or what about that? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I absolutely cannot stress enough how much challenging each other, as long as it's done in a respectful way that's really meant to end up with a better product. And it's not just being argumentative for the sake of arguing, but to really challenge each other in a healthy way, which everyone on the court does. We do have a very good court right now, and our court really is very respectful of each other and very constructive. Instead of destructive, very constructive. Mm-hmm. And it does end up with opinions that are much, much better and much more valuable, I believe, to the jurisprudence of the state of Texas.
Well, let's transition as we sort of wind down to the recent developments that I was alluding to earlier, just for 2 seconds worth of history, so that maybe we save a little time on this. The Supreme Court issued now 60 emergency orders. Beginning in March of 2020, I believe it was. And by those orders, allowed judges to continue doing business during the pandemic. And that included adopting remote proceedings. All of our judges got a Zoom account and learned how to use Zoom very quickly. And at least on the civil side, which is what your court deals with exclusively, were able to successfully implement Zoom to have hearings and in some cases, even certainly evidentiary hearings and even jury trials, virtual jury trials. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of discussion on our show about remote proceedings generally. And so folks who have listened to us maybe know a little bit of that history, but they say all good things must come to an end. And your court announced it really committed itself a week ago Friday when it issued what it titled as the final emergency order in response to Governor Abbott's declaration of a disaster. And so maybe for one thing that might be worth mentioning here, Judge, is what was the significance of that declaration of disaster as far as the court issuing emergency orders permitting trial courts to go forward? My recollection and understanding of it is we have certain requirements in our Constitution about how courts can operate. And those are some of those requirements carry forward into statutes. And one of those is that district courts must conduct business in, I think it's the county seat in their local county. And so if I have this right, I haven't really thought too much about this over the last 3 years, which is kind of funny, but there was no constitutional authority for courts to conduct remote proceedings without not only the Supreme Court's emergency order, but also, as I understand it, Governor Abbott's declaration of a state of disaster, because without that, there was no way that the Constitution and those statutes could effectively be set aside on a temporary basis and allow courts to proceed virtually. Do I basically have that right?
It was sort of.
Okay, remember, well, I'd love to be corrected.
Well, we were kind of just playing it by ear. I mean, all of a sudden, if you remember, it all happened so quickly. Everything is fine. We'd heard maybe a few stray cases from wherever that there was something called COVID, but it really did not hit home until I think it was Tom Hanks came down with it. And then what was it? It was some sporting event, remember, where all of the people on the, I'm not a big sports fan, but remember that? I think it was a basketball
the NCAA team? Tournament. Yeah, the NCAA tournament.
Yeah,
they had to
and that had
it.
To kind of shut down. Yeah. And then our own University of Texas president's wife came down with it, remember, who had been in New York City and came. And so all of a sudden, in a very short period of time, whoa, I mean, here we were. Mm-hmm. And so we were getting together at all hours of the day and night to figure out what we were going to do even before the governor had issued, because we knew at that time we needed to start staying at home. Everybody was figuring that out even before, if you remember, Governor Abbott said, you need to stay at home. And so we're trying to figure out, what do we do? I mean, trials have to continue. People are still entitled to justice regardless of what's going on in our environment. And we just never dealt with anything like this. Sure. Of course, at the time, we didn't know that it was going to go on for years.
Yeah.
Who would have had a clue that we would do 60 emergency orders? But we did know that we needed to do something. And so the court, largely through the leadership of Chief Justice Heck and at the time the head of Office of Court Administration, David Slayton, they really got together and came up with this idea of Zoom, which many of us had not even heard of before then. So we started playing around with the idea that we needed to start doing things by Zoom. We were the first court in the country to start doing that, and have really been a model for all the other states, thank goodness. And it was really largely through the work, like I say, of David Slayton and Chief Justice Heck, and all of us, really. I mean, getting together and putting our heads together, we decided to do our first appellate argument that was scheduled right after this all started, and we did it by Zoom. And we never missed one appellate argument. We never skipped a beat. And for appellate work, that's worked really well, because appellate work there doesn't have the issues that you may have in terms of evidentiary issues, in terms of making sure that things are authentic and accurate and all those kinds of things. We don't have those issues. And so really for just listening to oral argument, it worked very, very well. And I'm so thankful that we have that as a tool, because I think we were talking about before we came on live that we actually did some, even though we haven't been doing anything by Zoom for, gosh, I guess it's since September of 2021 or maybe 20, mm-hmm. no, 21, I think. We were able to use Zoom because of the ice storm that we had last week. Because we had people coming in from Dallas and Fort Worth who just, they couldn't fly. Everything was shut down. They couldn't drive to get to the airport, even if they could fly. And they certainly couldn't drive here because of the bad driving conditions. So we've used that last week. We used it last year when we had a similar ice situation. So I'm glad that we have the tool. Mm-hmm. It ended up being something, like I say, that we kind of have just felt it out as we've gone. It certainly helped when Governor Abbott issued the state of emergency declaration, because then we had a little bit more authority than just issuing emergency orders for the third branch of government. But we have cases that are coming before us right now in terms of how do we deal with that in the future? Does local government take priority, or do they have the final say as opposed to what the governor says? Those kinds of issues are still coming before us and have yet to be determined. Because there just were not any clear rules on how to deal with it. Just last weekend, I was in a meeting with ABA practitioners, and we had a meeting on this whole virtual world that we find ourselves in. And one of the attorneys from another state was saying that they are doing everything by Zoom still, everything. And I said, well, that's interesting, because in Texas, we just issued our final emergency order that is set to expire, I believe, in March. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we continued with those emergency orders, even after the real danger of the pandemic, at least we hope, had passed us, we had to have some authority, or we believed that we had to have some authority in order to allow proceedings to go on by Zoom, mm-hmm. virtually. But in this other state, they've been doing it. They don't have an emergency order. They didn't change their rules like we did. We got a rule out just a couple of weeks ago. They're just doing it. So there's, you know, who knows? Like I say, we're just playing this by ear. The constitutional issue that you're talking about, though, has to do not so much with the ability to do things virtually. Our problem with that was more that there just wasn't any authority for it. So we mm-hmm. wanted the rule. Mm-hmm. in place before we got rid of the emergency orders. But the Constitution is what has to do with a trial judge, basically, county or district judge, having to be in the county seat where the case is being heard. So for a lot of larger metropolitan areas, that wasn't really a problem, because even if they were at their home, they were in the county seat probably. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't mm-hmm. really a constitutional issue, but it was an issue that had to do with just lack of authority, or we just right. making it up. And so sometimes at the beginning of an emergency like that, you have to do the best you can and know that the greater need for our citizens' constitutional rights to justice and to access to the courts to protect their due process rights, whatever the rights are that are issued, took priority over the fact that we didn't have the authority for it. And I think it could even possibly take priority over some constitutional limits, which it did in those cases, mm-hmm. because there were judges who were able to hear things virtually, even though, particularly in these areas out in West Texas, where a judge will be the district judge over courts over many, many counties. And mm-hmm. so they were able to actually hold court from one area within the county seat, and that did violate the Constitution, but we allowed that by emergency order.
Right.
We couldn't change it, though, by rule because of the Constitution, because we no longer had that emergency. Mm-hmm. We just figured out it's a good tool mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. we need to be able to use. I think it's important that people realize that the new rule, however, does not allow jury trials to be held virtually absent agreement of the parties. If the parties agree, then they are able to have a jury trial virtually. But if anyone objects, then there are no jury trials virtually. But other than that, the court does have the authority to have things done virtually, and all appellate courts do if they see that there's good cause to do so.
Right. Well, I'll hold that rule. And again, we're talking about new rule of civil procedure 21D primarily. There are some other amendments that were necessary when the court adopted that, such as changes to notice requirements and so forth, because parties have to be notified of the method that the court, by which the court is going to actually hold the hearing. I'll hold that rule, though. You mentioned Texas being a leader in the post-pandemic time, or actually the pandemic time, by creating Zoom accounts and getting everyone up and running on Zoom. I haven't seen a rule like this in another jurisdiction. As you say, other courts are still just kind of doing whatever in other states. And Texas, the Supreme Court in particular, has been proactive in not only with the release of 60 emergency orders to help our justice system continue on as it needed to, but also in now figuring out a path forward with trying to implement what this rule seems to do, Justice Lerman, is it tries to take the good that came out of using remote technology and make it available and set some parameters for that. One of which being, as you've already mentioned, that there's no jury trial that can be held virtually unless everyone agrees. But there are some procedural processes built into the rule. There's a process for objecting to virtual appearances. The one sort of overarching theme that I think I get out of the new rule is that it sort of assumes that proceedings will be in person, and then, but there are ways to go about doing it differently, either by at the court's notification to the parties or by a party's request. So that's a new one. I mean, it hasn't been presumed that we're going to be live in a lot of things for a long time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is the idea. One thing that we learned as we were going through this emergency situation was that there were some good things that came out of it. And actually, I was up for election last year. And in going around the state and to talking to different, particularly members of the legal profession, lawyers, about whether how these virtual hearings had helped them, what they didn't like about it, we got a lot of feedback that there really was some really important areas that we need to keep virtual trials or hearings to be available. And so back, I think it was in December of 21, we appointed a committee that was headed by Chief Justice Tracy Christopher and also as her assistant chair, Emily Miskell, who had done a lot of exceptional work with regard to really jumping in on the whole Zoom bandwagon early on. And they had a blue ribbon committee that really went through every single rule in our entire system, rules of civil procedure, rules of appellate procedure, et cetera, and identified every single thing that was affected by this virtual proceedings. And so we had a very good blueprint of what needed to be done. They came out with recommendations. It was a very thorough report that then went to our Supreme Court Advisory Committee, or what we call a SCAC, which is where all our proposed rules go before we implement any changes. Because, of course, anytime we're going to have any kind of change at all to our rules, we just don't do it without thinking about it a lot. And it all goes to SCAC, and there's a lot of study and investigation, et cetera, that goes into those determinations. And then they report back to us, and then we may tweak it, we may send it back, whatever. But we never do change rules without it going through this very intense process of study and deliberation. And that happened with these rules before they were able to come to fruition. And like I say, that finally happened 2 weeks ago, but we had been working on it since December of 21. But the process, if it's going to be really thoroughly done, it's not going to be done overnight. And I think we may be the first state in the country who has actually implemented a rule that is allowing for this type of virtual proceeding. I talked to some people from other states who said they're still working on emergency orders. Like I said, I talked to another who said they're doing it, basically. So hopefully this will be a blueprint for other states to also go through the process of figuring out a rule that will work for them.
Well, as with any new rule, there's typically growing pains. Right. And so it remains to be seen how, I mean, this is so new that I'm sure there will be some development, as we say, and courts are going to be asked to hear objections to virtual appearances, or I suppose live appearances too. And it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. There is a process built into the rule for the court to decide those objections. And then, you know, we'll see what happens after that, I guess. And there are some open questions at this point.
There always are.
What would we do, Justice Lehrman, as appellate lawyers specifically, if there were no open questions,
That's right. No gray areas
in the law? So, but I, for one, am super excited about this development, just because I think putting an end to emergency orders was a very worthy goal and a worthy thing to do. But releasing this rule, piggybacking on the end of emergency orders, made a lot of sense. Right. And definitely. So I think we will look forward. We may have to do a whole episode later, Jody, on just on this change, because it's going to be interesting.
Oh, I think it's great
how it develops later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. We got so much input from many, many lawyers around the state who really did have opinions about it. And it's kind of interesting. You know, a lot of the lawyers from rural areas, of course, we were in San Angelo on the campaign trail and had a lot of lawyers that attended one of our luncheons. And they absolutely very much expressed the view that it just made their lives and their ability to help their clients so much better, because they live in the middle of nowhere and they didn't have to travel so much. So it was very much a cost savings to their clients and more efficient in terms of what they were able to deliver to their clients. There was a lot of discussion about whether or not jury trials would be mandated over objection. And that's really what kept the committee from going forward for a while, because everybody got really stuck into that discussion, even though internally the court had already recognized the problems with that. Of course, we weren't at liberty to discuss that publicly, but we knew that there were a lot of problems with forcing jury trials to be held virtually over objection. And so finally, we just decided that we would just issue publicly our consensus that we weren't going to have that. Mm-hmm. And so once we did that, then people were able to get over what they were so afraid of and talk about all these other issues that we're talking about, having to do with what you brought notice, Todd, et cetera, all the things that had to be dealt with to really finally get a finished product. So we'll see. Just like the statutes that come before us, we'll have the rules come before us and we'll see what happens.
Well, we are so grateful for this time. But before we let you go, our tradition is to kind of always wrap up with a tip or a war story, if you have one you'd like to share.
Oh, gosh, I forgot that you were going to ask me that. It's a tip or a war story. Well, I guess just the first thing that comes to mind is our court is very, very formal. And it's not because we're full of ourselves, but it's because of what we do and what we represent and the importance of that to the people of our great state. And with that, we are very prompt. And those of you who are appellate lawyers know we're never late. We don't ever start after the time we should. And so if you have a case that's set for 9 o'clock, you better be there at 9 o'clock. And if it's set for 10 o'clock, you might want to be in there at 20 till, because sometimes we'll go in early, but we never go in late. So one day, and we have a television inside our robing room where we can see the courtroom and we know what's going on inside of the courtroom for safety purposes, et cetera. And so we see we're getting ready. It's approaching 9 o'clock and the lawyer for the petitioner is not there. And so we're like, oh, okay, well, now what do we do? And so at the time, I think Chief Justice Wallace Jefferson was Chief Justice. So we go out and the table's empty. And so we proceeded with the respondent who made his argument. And about 5 minutes into that argument, this lawyer comes running in and runs. I'm sure that the lawyer was a little bit frazzled and runs in front of the opposing party's table, counsel table, goes, sits at her seat and sits there and waits for her turn. And I'm watching this thinking, oh my goodness, she's just going to be so nervous. Mm-hmm. She's going to be so out of whack. This just isn't going to work. Oh my goodness. And she started, y'all, and she did not skip a beat. She was just as eloquent and it prepared and didn't seem to frazzle her at all. It was very impressive. I'll say that. Well, it turns out she was one of these lawyers who had come several hours ahead of time and had gone to the law library, the state law library, to really just be sure you read everything mm-hmm. over again and get super, you know, on top of everything. And she lost track of time.
Oh, no.
And so she actually got a call from somebody who was over her where she was working, saying, "You're not there," because everything is televised and they were watching.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, gosh.
You need to get into the room they're going. And so the answer there is, number one, be sure you put a timer on your phone
for
at least 30 minutes before you're supposed to be in the courtroom. And be aware that if you are late, we're not going to wait.
Yeah.
The parade will go on.
Oh, my gosh.
That is something.
So, I want to thank you all for doing this. That's so wonderful that we can do these kind of things again virtually that we can reach more people and communicate. One thing we try to do as justices on the court is really humanize the court to not just members of the public. That's certainly important, but also to lawyers and to even appellate lawyers who know us more than just average citizen on the street. But still, that's a big thing we try to do so that people can understand that this is not just some court up on an ivory tower that's just issuing opinions and not working and not studying and not caring. Because that is not the case. And I think more that we can explain that to people and certainly help non-members of the legal profession understand that these are real issues that affect their lives all the time, whether it has to do with taxation, public education, I mean, all kinds of issues that affect them every single day of their lives. And so it's important to be engaged and to understand the importance that we always say the importance of the rule of law, but it's not just talk. It really is important that that shop owner down the street can know that when he or she goes and buys those mattresses or whatever that they want to sell to the public, that they can count on the fact that they will be delivered because they've entered into a contract. And if they don't, and if that isn't done, that they have recourse to the courts as long as those courts adhere to the rule of law. And so it really does affect every single person. And so thank you all for doing this. We appreciate it very much.
Our pleasure. And thank you again for spending the time with us, Judge. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.